Oh, hey there. I'm Guy Brandman. Welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining, our digital strategist, Winter Mitchell.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello, Winter. Good to have you back.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And pop culture scholar, Karen Toxin.
Hi, Guy.
Hello, Karen. How's your week going?
I've been in like three cities, but it's all good.
Where were you touring?
Took a vacay to the desert and then went to Philadelphia. I'm home for this next 48 hours and then I'm leaving for Chicago tomorrow night.
It's very jet set academic. Mm-hmm. And everything President Trump is warring against.
Exactly.
And Margaret is out, so we have a special guest, comedian and writer Tara Jepsen.
Hi, Guy.
Hello, Tara.
Tara.
Tara, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Tara, what should we know about you other than it's pronounced Tara?
I'm a middle-aged adult woman skateboarder and writer living in Los Angeles. Yeah.
I call her Tara Ray Jepsen, just so people, you know what's up.
That's cool.
Fair. Tara, how many times have you broken your wrist?
Never.
Really?
Yeah. I had, late adult onset skateboarding, so I'm much more cautious than a lot of, the younger people.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Also, clearly, good calcium intake. coming up on this episode, we're going to talk about where to find the hot, hot lesbian action beyond the L word. What are our favorite shows by and about gay women? Plus, singer-songwriter Lisa Loeb agreed to take part in our brand new segment, Four Questions.
Karen wants to know, how does it feel or did it feel to be something of a queer icon and beloved by so many bespectacled lesbians in the 1990s?
We'll hear Lisa's answer in a bit, along with our latest jams. And let's not forget, it's Maximum Fun Drive. We'll tell you more about that later, but first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. Karen Toxin, what are you all about this week?
So, I'm all about the most recent episode of Fresh Off the Boat, called The Flush, which explains this unfortunate phenomenon called the Asian Flush, which happens to most East Asians, or a lot of East Asians I know, when they drink. Mm-hmm. Basically, you turn beet red, etc. Being Filipino, who are the Irish of Asia, I don't have this problem because we apparently have this enzyme that can process alcohol. It's a gift from colonialism, probably. But yeah, basically, Lewis explains to Eddie why he turned beet red when he started experimenting with beer. And it's literally like one beer that all of his little crew of kids shares. And Eddie flips out because he's like, what's happening to me? I'm getting hot. I'm getting all these blisters and I'm red. And so we get a really succinct explanation of what it is that turns Asians, particularly Chinese people, red when you're drinking.
How do you feel Fresh Off the Boat is doing in its third season with its job of sort of like sailing in between the Skillet and Charybdis of being a just workhorse family comedy and the Asian show on TV? Mm.
I think it's doing a pretty good job of, basically being a family comedy and working the Asian material in as things that flesh out the characters and the kind of situations sometimes of the show, or sometimes also around the Jessica's pride around bargaining, or how she doesn't want to spend that extra $20 and would rather drive to Georgia to pick the damn chair up and that kind of thing. And so I do think that it's limiting that pretty well if it wants to stay a kind of mainstream popular family show. But there are also really some pretty incredible and touching and resonant things, not unlike the Flush explanation and some other kind of stuff from
one
the show.
One of the coolest choices on the show was from the sex talk episode in season one or season two, making Lewis a really cool dad who wants his kids to have a good time. Like, it's so easy to lean into the stock characters of the immigrant parents. And there are times when Jessica, it's really great that Constance Wu is so young and it gives Jessica a different feel, but sometimes she really can be Tiger Mommy, where Lewis is full of energies that are always surprising.
Yeah, but Jessica's Tiger Mom also loves Sarah McLachlan.
She's so great.
And does all, to be appropriate to this week's theme of our episode. And so I do think
the lesbian bar she goes to.
Yeah, she loves to go to the lesbian bar because she's not harassed. Everybody's like, play Sarah McLachlan on the jukebox and doesn't talk. It's all fantastic. And Constance Wu is constantly amazing.
I would like to make one observation. Since Ali Wong has gone from being a full-time writer on the show to just a consultant, the number of jokes about pork bone soup improving your hearing have gone down considerably.
So true. So true.
Yeah.
I love that show too much.
Oh, and plus yeah. Ming Na made a cameo this week.
I missed one episode and you come in with absolutely everything.
Yeah.
Winter, what are you all about this week?
So last week I wasn't here because I went to South by Southwest Interactive, which was a mistake. I think that this year was supposed to be, I think last year when I talked about it on the show, it was, there was a, I predicted that virtual reality was going to reach peak saturation and that there, it was going to be really hard for people to come up with something the next year because it was dominated last year with so many brands trying to push out their version of VR. So it spilled over into this year, which made it soups boring, but everybody has less money. And then there's still this hangover from the election. So all the bros were just like passive aggressive in their approach to everything. I felt like the city only started to come alive when the, as the musicians started pouring in, and there was like a bunch of different performances. Lizzo performed. I missed that. I missed like all the best parties, but the aftermath of Interactive felt really dry.
All right, Winter, let's go through. Of the 2 years of this show, Winter has made two big predictions from South by Southwest.
Yes.
First one was Meerkat, everybody. Get excited for Meerkat.
Damn it!
Which was...
Institutional memory, that's what it's called.
That's exactly what it's called. Shit!
Not the best of predictions, but then last year it was VR is coming for you. And that really was very correct with...
So I was 50, I was like 50-50.
Yeah, so what would you say this year? What do you see looking into your crystal ball?
I feel like this year, I think there has to be some reorganization 100% because what people think are panels are not panels. So I think with the social activism and the consciousness that we, most liberal people, I mean, there were a lot of conservatives at this year's South by, you can tell. But what people are overwhelmingly needing right now are less apps. So you're not going to see tons of apps that are going to do anything for to improve your life, like Uberfy your life, because all of those apps were just getting beaten over the head. I think it's going to be a lot more like, how do you be more socially conscious? How do you have more activism? How do you have quiet activism? How do you protect yourself online? A lot of discussion about that. That's still such a prevalent conversation about how are women being protected, how are men not helping women be protected. There was a lot of discussion about that, but I honestly, I really wanted to see James Comey. That's the way I scheduled my trip there, and he didn't show up. So I went to Cheryl Boone Isaacs, and I went to the Sweet Green CEO. I ended up going to panels that I didn't anticipate I'd have to go to because there were so many people filing into panels, and these people feel like the cat got their tongue. They don't want to speak on level with right now because I think everybody's freaking out. So I think it's going to be like social activism. Guy's show was the highlight of my trip, 100%.
Oh, that's very sweet. We did a live edition of Talk Show the Game Show to promote the fact that it is coming out April 5th on True TV, 10 p.m. Please watch my show.
Everybody was like cracking up and spilling their wine, so you know it was good.
It's just like a taping of Pop Rocket.
It's pretty much.
We do a lot of wine spilling. Tara, what are you spilling your wine about this week?
I'm spilling my wine about Rachel Maddow. So kind of in keeping with the theme for tonight, lesbian protectivism. I feel last week when she was had announced that she had Trump's tax returns and then had like two pages of the 2005 return, because I feel like she had been doing such extraordinary reporting for like months now. I mean, having just like desperately needed her and to just like feel sane or not like throwing up and having a panic attack constantly. I felt like I was watching Twitter and watching her like a normal person. And the set, like 5 minutes into her show, people were just like, this is really what all she got. And just like tearing her to shreds. And I was like, so she just laid out like the Russia thing she's been working on for weeks.
Yeah.
Everything she's been doing is so deep and so user-friendly, like laid out in a very intelligent, present,
factual. Except,
yeah, like you're picking up what she's laying down.
Yeah. I mean, I really think she's transforming our ability to engage with and ideally undermine this administration. And then I was like, really, y'all are going to freak out about like, there wasn't enough for you today? There's been enough. I mean, and this is, I get that if she's advertising having his tax returns. Like, there's part of me that's like, I understand why this is disappointing for everybody. But at the same time, are you kidding me? Do I get to swear?
Yes. Yes. As much as you like.
Thank you. I feel, you know, like I want to be sure she's okay.
Do you feel like the tweet was like poorly calibrated, or do you feel like in a world where Fox News is the top rated everything, she has to fight back with whatever she can?
Yeah. I felt like, to me, it appeared to be some kind of probably pressure from a producer, someone at MSNBC being like, we're going to hype the fuck out of this and we're going to get a lot of people watching. And so because there wasn't more of a tax return, what she did with that was lay out a sort of outline of all the stuff she's been doing for the last few months. So all the new viewers that came in,
oh, that's interesting,
got a foundation for wherever she'll go with this from now. So I'm like, I feel like
that's actually pretty fucking clever.
I feel like that's what she did to make up for the fact that, yeah, it was a little bit of a,
but it was
overstating
also
what she had.
But it was also unusual to even get access to this material. And I think that that's part of what she laid out in the show, too. It's just like, this is kind of, a kind of groundbreaking thing to have this particular source, private source, shared with us, because he wouldn't disclose it, right? So, yep. Anyway.
And yeah, that even being leaked, like, to me, that also cracked open the potential for her to get more of those papers, more of the tax returns from a sort of, like, through, I don't remember which journalist she got it from. Someone handed it to her. She had that
it
guy.
It was mailed to someone.
Yeah, that guy that's the finance.
Yeah, and then he turned it over to her.
Yeah.
I think that, like, this is the type of stuff that you have to be doing. We're not going to get answers immediately, but I think it's in this media landscape that's hyper-competitive. Everybody is trying to get the story. And for her to be on television and to be doing this work every night, she deserves all the credit. I'm still giving her the benefit of the doubt.
Well, it's also
two pages is a lot.
It's also just a situation where Republicans control both houses of Congress.
Right.
Nothing's going to happen. Like, we're not going to learn anything without journalists getting stuff
exactly
somewhat illicitly.
Yeah, it was David K. Johnston who was sent those two pages of the tax return. And I just feel like, you know what? We saw how that went. Ideally, someone keeps shuttling pieces to
somebody
him.
Somebody has
and
a whole bunch
of
shit like conspiracy
theory. You know.
Yeah.
Hey, I enjoyed being reminded that Rachel existed and I should watch her more. this week, I'm all about the Throwing Shade TV show on TV Land. It's, I think the final original episode is going to air this week. Basically, one of the podcasts from Maximum Fun got turned into a TV show, and it's really taking the sort of like Daily Show, Samantha Bee, John Oliver, weekly wrap-up of news, and giving it really different, fun voices and takes. It's Brian Safi and Aaron Gibson. In the podcast, it was always just sort of like riffing on news stories. But in the TV show, they've been adding in sketches. There's a segment like Know This Bitch or something like that, and they just like talked about Jackie Speer from San Francisco, who's a congressman who like survived like getting shot at Jonestown and all of this stuff, and it was like really, really like sink your teeth into the news kind of stuff, and it's super, super funny. Aaron is full of so much rage at all times. It's the most delightful. And Brian is so funny. And like, they had Will Ferrell on the show. They had a bunch of great people come and do sketches on the show. So it's available on demand. They're going to be rerunning it on TV Land. But you should definitely check out Throwing Shade. And I was remiss in not mentioning it until this point in time, because they are too talented and are part of the Maximum Fun family.
You've definitely mentioned it before.
I've mentioned it as one of my favorite podcasts, but I haven't talked about the TV show.
Okay.
All right, you are listening to Pop Rocket. We're going to be right back to talk about Sapphic TV and film. But first, it's time to talk about Maximum Fun. Okay, you guys, Maximum Fun has always been a listener-supported network, and Maximum Fun Drive only happens one time a year. It's the most special time of year. It's our best shows, we offer great thank you gifts, it's a great celebration of all things Maximum Fun, and the best time to sign on as a member. Or if you're already a member, upgrade your membership. Karen Tongson, why should people become supporters of Maximum Fun?
You are listening to and enjoying tremendous fun content from Dykes About Town. You're also, you know, think about the money that you spend on your daily bottle of Booch or, you know, your Starbucks or what have you.
Lady to lady means as much to you, right?
Exactly.
Can I pet your dog is an important part of your life.
Absolutely. And these, you know, we're your friends. We're your pals. And why wouldn't you throw a couple bucks at your pal for, you know, giving you a good time?
You guys, we have a goal of reaching 10,000 new and upgrading members. So please join in the people who are supporting this podcast and other podcasts. And Windsor, I mean, they get some pretty gay, great gifts, right?
They get
right?
gay gifts, too. they get some exclusive bonus content. That's for $5 a month. You're going to get the exclusive episode, the guy-centric episode, I believe, that's being dropped in there, right? Like a golden ticket.
Yes.
Okay, wow. $5, guys? Come on. You can't get that from Netflix. And then $10 per month, there's an awesome pin that is basically Pop Rocket. So for 10, and your introductory level at $5 for bonus content, and then for $10, you get the pin and you get the bonus content. And it's designed, there's a design for every Max Fun show. So you just pick your favorite, but your favorite is Pop Rocket.
Your
right?
favorite obviously. Is Pop Rocket.
Yeah, obviously.
Now, Winter, how can people donate?
You go to MaximumFun.org and you click on donate, and then you select the membership level that works for you, works best for you. Give your credit card number, basic info, then you're a member. And it comes out every month. Your donation when you sign up starts automatically each month.
So you guys, please remember that it is your donations that keep this entire network going, and it's really important that you help us reach that goal of 10,000 new and upgrading members during this Maximum Fun Drive. We need people to donate now. I know that you intend to donate. I know that you have the best thoughts about donating, but let's be honest, you're probably not going to go to your computer. You have other important things to do. So why not just do it now? Sling 10 bucks a month our way, and it keeps the light on. It keeps Jesse's children in clothes. go to MaximumFun.org/donate and give us whatever you can, because we appreciate it. And it allows us to keep giving you the high, high quality content that you so love. And please remember, when they ask you which Maximum Fun podcast you listen to say that Pop Rocket is the best and you love us the most. and then list all of your favorite Pop Rocket panelists in order, but make us all a tie for first, because how can you pick? Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are...
Winter Mitchell.
Tara Jepsen.
And Karen Tongson.
And today, in honor of Women's History Month, we wanted to talk about the TV and film that best represents what it's like to be a lady who loves to love the lovely ladies. Karen, give us a big overview for lesbians in cinema and television. What were dykes on TV like in the 50s?
Okay, well, they were all married to Dick Van Dyke. Just kidding. No. You know, part of representing lesbianism on screen has always meant that somehow you would have to eradicate the lesbian at the end of it, or turn her into somebody evil, or shunt her off to some man who could reform her.
Yeah.
And so for many years, even into the present moment, this happens. But for many years, lesbians on film screens and TV screens were always, you know, either sickly and dying once they experienced their sapphic love, or had it interrupted by a deep hidden desire for D.
Yeah.
Or what have you. So, and it took a while until basically the 90s and really this kind of blossoming of new queer cinema, where there were a lot of independent films made that began to present some happier outcomes and endings and futures and possibilities for lesbians.
All right, Tara, which do you prefer? A highly coded 1950s butch secretary who's just weirdly obsessed with her boss's wife, or Ellie Mae Clampett? Or a 90s Laura Ashley dress, like soft-haired lesbian clearly played by a straight woman with long, long fake fingernails? Which speaks more to your soul?
Well, it's kind of the be it or fuck it situation. Like, for the fuck it sitch, I really like the butch secretary thing. But I know that when I see, like, the Laura Ashley girls with the nails and stuff, that I get kind of, like, that makes me kind of tittery in this sort of way, like when I was at a wedding 15 years ago, and there was this, like, I walked into a bathroom and there was all these girls that I call the Texas cheerleaders. One of the guys getting me. There were all these just like lady ball, femi straight girls all preening around with their makeup, and I was like, oh my God, we all need to fuck. That's what's happening right now. That's what's happening right now. And so that's how I feel about the Laura Ashley ladies. Like, I rarely see anyone that makes any like romantic or whatever that I can eroticize on TV, but.
Uh-huh. Karen, like the 90s brought us like new queer cinema. It brought us like Go Fish and.
The incredibly true adventures of two girls in love.
But it also led to this mainstream commodified version of quote-unquote lesbianism, like J-Lo and Gigli, like lesbians whose only purpose was to make a woman whose purpose in the film was straightness, was sex with a man, to make her seem a little bit more exotic and interesting.
Well, or there was also the rise of the evil murderous bisexual.
Yes.
But I think that one of the things that was exciting about the 90s is that there was this whole moment called Lesbian Chic. Remember
yeah.
with Katie Lang on the cover of Vanity Fair getting shaved by Cindy Crawford, right? And I think that set the tone. There were even lesbians on the cover of Time magazine, both kind of like soccer mom lesbians with short hair and like, you know, chambray shirts, like
yeah.
doing a prom pose. But and so there was this, and the aesthetic of the 90s was really amenable to lesbian style. Flannel, grunge,
oh,
Doc Martens. Right. So there was a whole thing that was happening in mainstream culture that, you know, made people more curious about being. And plus, you know, with all the rainbow rings and everything and the Clinton administration and all that stuff, there was this sense of a kind of openness to gay culture, and lesbians were a hot thing for a moment. Women's music, the Lilith Fair, until suddenly that wasn't the deal anymore.
Winter, who's your favorite icon of 90s lesbian TV or film?
Gia, I guess maybe because that was like the first time it all these things I was interested in anyway collided.
So if you're a child,
yeah.
Gia was a HBO or Showtime TV
20 years this year, I think.
Yeah.
TV movie starring Angelina Jolie,
yes.
just when we were getting to know her.
She was won a gold, it was her first Golden Globe for it.
About a bisexual model.
Yes.
Or was she gay or bisexual?
No, no.
She was mostly gay.
She was a lesbian. Gia. Gia Carangi. She was like the first supermodel. She was like the Cindy Crawford before Cindy Crawford. She was on everybody's cover, mostly Cosmopolitan. And she was also a serious heroin addict. And she was also part of that Studio 54 vibe. And she was also she had a hard on for this married woman. But the movie was an amalgamation of like all these different lovers that she had been with. But it just sort of really, it's a tragic film, but it was like tragic lesbianism.
And it gave us Angelina Jolie, and it allowed us to sort mm-hmm. of like, stir in her narrative of bisexuality and her relationship with Jenny Shimizu.
Yeah.
And that was really exciting. One of Karen's grand theories is that reality television has given us better and realer gay people than scripted stuff ever could. And in the 90s, we really did have, we had that TV movie about Margareta Kammermeier.
Glenn Close.
Yeah. And I feel like we had so many of those like real life stories gave us lesbian characters who were a little bit more grounded than the ones that a bunch of straight guys in their 40s would write.
Yeah, and there was an effort to do like to capture like LGBT history, or at that point it was mostly L and G. But then there was also characters on really popular primetime shows of the 90s, like Carolyn Susan had a lesbian wedding on Friends in 1996, right? Ross's wife, right, became a lesbian. And that was like one of the big, you know, kind of running themes and plot lines of Friends.
It always felt to me like the worst affectation. It was like,
lesbians are chic now. Let's throw a lesbian wedding in.
It was just like a zany word and idea. And there was never anything to those characters that made them feel in any way.
Although Candace Gingrich was the person who married them.
Oh,
right,
yes.
On screen. Anyway, but yeah, there were a lot of opportunities for cameos from real-life lesbians on 90s TV, but there wasn't really anything fleshed out, or there weren't very many characters that on television that were of note really during that period.
Until we got like the grand transformation that was the Ellen program, where you went from Ellen being just like generic sitcom lady who's going on dates that don't work to like a season and a half of her being asexual and watching her friends have adventures to that final season that sort of like slap fought with being able to represent a gay coming out story. You guys were lesbians on the town at that point in time. Did it feel gross to you? Did it feel exciting to you?
What year was that?
97.
97. Okay. I didn't really pay. I remember when that happened, and I remember seeing a clip of that thing, but I also was living in San Francisco then. I moved to San Francisco in 96, and I feel like from the second I landed there, my friends and I were all just flooring it to be a different kind of queer. That, like, the idea of mainstream lesbian was so repugnant to us that we were just all, like, fucking each other on pool tables and bars, like on bus stops, that we were all just like ripping each other's bodies apart and destroying furniture, showing how we were not that kind of queer, you know? So I feel like I remember being aware of that, but I didn't even have a TV then. And I just remember that if it wasn't utterly insane and destroying everybody's ideas about what it meant to be queer, then
I do remember it. I mean, and I was there at the same time. I was also in the Bay Area at the same time, but I was in grad school. So I was dorkily watching Ellen on TV. And I do remember that I was glad that it finally happened. I feel like it just sort of, it was such a Shonda that, you know, that there were that. But also I kind of missed the humor of the closet from the earlier episodes. But it did give me like some tingles to see that happen. Although I knew that the show was dead in the water the minute it did happen.
This is so hard, but I think I've realized that I am. I can't even say the word. Why can't I say the word? I mean, why can't I just say? I mean, what is wrong? That why do I have to be so ashamed? I mean, why can't I just say the truth? I mean, be who I am. I'm 35 years old. I'm so afraid to tell people. I mean, I just... Susan, I'm gay.
It is the tragic gay situation of the woman doing the hard work and then Will and Grace flying in the next season and being able to take all of the benefit from the, you know, the work that was done. And there is something interesting about the fact that, like, as queer people, you so frequently... Like, we don't let anyone under college age be gay in any way. And then once you do come out, so frequently you check out of popular culture in significant ways. And so these victories that do mean so much, like, we're not participatory in. We're not making that kind of stuff. That's definitely, like, less true now. Karen, how well do you remember Much Ado About Nothing?
Oh, I remember it pretty well.
Okay.
With Sigh No More, that opening with Emma Thompson in that dress, the cheesecloth dress.
Well, they're...
Sorry, I know it too well.
No, it's so good. That is the fleshiest and most wonderful of opening scenes. But there's that Don John speech so beautifully given to us by Keanu Reeves. Where he talks about, like, oh, if I'm the bastard son of the king... And I guess I don't have any other, like, I'm never going to be the hero. So I guess I better lean into being the villain. And I feel like for a significant period of time, from Rebecca to Basic Instinct, it was this thing of, we're never going to see ourselves in any way. Like, best option is victim or awesome, awesome evil person.
Serial killer, heavenly creature.
Like, single white female toyed with that, but not in a way that she... She was clearly in love with Bridget Fonda's character, but it never really went there. But you always kind of assumed there was like some sapphic undertones.
Yeah, but that's the thing, though, is that, I mean, even from like 1968, the killing of Sister George and stuff like that, you know, like lesbians were pathological and had something else wrong with them. And therefore, you know, they had to, you know, they were murderous and then they would have to like suffer a terrible end. But there was a kind of overcorrection, I think, once positive representations and visibility and the whole GLAAD project came in, where everybody just wanted to, you know, Laura Ashley lesbians on screen and to make everything okay. One I think, particularly radiant TV moment in the 90s that was on Northern Exposure, and it was a bottle episode about the founding of the town of Sicily, Alaska. It's called Sicily, this episode, and it's basically about how these two sort of Victorian, like, tough lesbians ended up founding the town, and, you know, because they were intellectuals and they wanted to have a salon and stuff like that.
And it did sort of give you, if I remember correctly, like somewhat sickly femme who ends up dying.
Yeah, she's a sickly femme who ends up dying, and that's why the town is named after her. But it was super tingly. But I like repressed Victorian tingly things. So sometimes when you ask the question, like, you know, of Tara, it's like, do you prefer these representations of repression or, like, just full-on, like, floppy boobs in the L word kind of stuff?
But what about,
what is it going to be?
What about the representation of Chasing Amy, where a bro gets a hold of it? I mean, ostensibly, Kevin Smith is...
I hated that movie.
Really? I don't know. I'm
a butch lesbian. Of course I hated that movie.
Well, no, the only reason I love that movie is because they don't let... At the end... I mean, spoiler. Mm-hmm. If you haven't seen Chasing Amy, like, fuck off. Like, at the end of the movie, she doesn't compromise her identity or her sexuality.
Yeah, she's queer.
Queer.
The weird Banky is secretly gay thing made me feel uncomfortable. But she had a surprising amount of agency.
Yes.
A movie like that.
Yeah. And I call dudes who, like, there are dudes who are only into lesbians, I call them Amy Chasers. Just some new lingo for you out there.
I don't even understand the world that exists in.
Tara, can you point to a first time seeing a lesbian in film that you were like, oh, that didn't make me feel gross?
Well, Yara Greyjoy on Game of Thrones.
Yes.
It was really, I mean, I rarely see anyone that I find compelling. And when I saw that, I was just like, oh, this is so rad. She's just in the mix with what everyone else is doing. She's being robustly sexual in this way, but also her storyline is about power, and it's about her wanting to be, you know, also to whatever, the person who rules stuff. So she gets to, I don't know, that moment of presentation when she has the, like, I want to have this kingdom and have my wife and my son, or however she phrases it. I was like, it was really one of the few moments that I haven't just, like, cringed at that made me so happy.
There's a lesbian film that I finally watched in preparation for this that I had been making jokes about for years, but it is 1982's Personal Best, with Mariel Hemingway as a young aspiring pentathlete and this woman Pat something or other, who was a real life track and field star, who plays the woman who basically inaugurates her to lesbianism and also takes her to the next level as an athlete before handing her off to Scott Glenn, who has the exact same haircut as her.
The only difference is his mustache.
Yes. And the thing I found very interesting about it, because I also watched Thelma and Louise in the run-up to this, is the way that Personal Best is one of those things that feels amazing, because it's both figuring out how to make a lesbian story, and it's also innovating in the way you talk about, or like, that sports are represented in film. And I was really excited by the way that it took narrative growth of both sorts for this to feel interesting and honest, because it was contemplating women's bodies in a way that film doesn't. And I read a couple of reviews, and it was the great situation of Roger Ebert was like, that's the best movie I've ever seen. And Vincent Canby from the New York Times was like, wow, Ridley Scott sure is into lean, lanky women, and kind of couldn't understand. He couldn't understand why this movie was spending so much time examining women's bodies other than it being a sexualization for men's benefit. And there is a arm wrestling scene in that movie that is the hottest fucking thing you have ever seen.
Oh, yeah.
And there is a scene with the two of them running barefoot up sand, and, like, both of them clearly just, like, physically giving of themselves everything that they've got. And the weird way you see that, like, they are both benefiting from this mixture of love and competition, it made me, as a gay man, kind of jealous that something that amazing had been made, because, of course, all of gayness should be for my benefit.
Well, you know, a lot of lesbians of my generation have that film as a kind of text of their, you know, they saw it on cable late at night or some shit like that. And they're like, what's this? And it became this thing that sort of unlocked the door. That's why the Team Dresh album is called Personal Bad.
Yeah, but can we talk about that for a second? Yeah. How lesbianism was relegated for the longest time to something that you only could like get from late night cable or like in a magazine. It was suggested like a nudie magazine. It was only suggested like for the longest time. I was growing up seeing lesbianism in action in San Francisco, and I couldn't under and I was always able to draw the parallels between like this why is there only just this one thing and why is this other? And I think that has always made me interested and made me so early to accept lesbianism as not something that is other. That was a comment, not really a statement.
It's a great comment. I was just popped in my mind. One of the movies that I watched constantly at my dad's as a kid was Victor Victoria.
Yes.
Along with the like Gallagher special that was on at the same time.
Right.
But I watched that so much, and I remember I loved that movie, and I remember the whole moment of her pulling off her headpiece and the idea that she was revealing that she was a man.
Yeah.
Was so exciting.
Yeah, and Yentl, for me, was that particular cinematic text, too, where I was just like, oh, my God, it's Barbara Streisand, and she's dressed like a man, and why do I want to be her right now?
Yeah, and mixed with performance, mixed with this exciting singing scene that I was just like, what, you know, I was in Green Bay, Wisconsin, at my dad's just being like, what is this?
Okay, so do you think, as young lesbians, like, gender play like that? Or badass bitchness, like sort of like women taking and asserting power, was more interesting to you in coded lesbian terms?
They were badass bitches, though. I mean, that's the thing, is that Yentl was taking power because she wanted an education, damn it, and she was going to do what she needed to, and that meant becoming Anshul, right, or whatever his name was. But, you know, I don't know for you if badass bitchery is more important.
Well, yeah. God, man, I don't know. I'm trying to think back of how it felt to watch that. And I mean, there was that, what I remember, it's probably a terrible movie, but it's what I remember is her like having this like unique act and wanting to be the star, the centerpiece of that venue, right?
Yeah.
So there was like a feminist narrative. I mean, that's the thing, is that the gender play was often about a feminist narrative and about getting access to things and to power that you wanted. And so there was, you know, lesbian feministy.
Okay, so I also watched Thelma and Louise. And what was interesting is I had only seen it in like 91 or 92 on video. And I was thinking about it in terms of so much of the 90s was exploring quote unquote lesbianism in terms of straight women experimenting or having play or blah, 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 which feels tiresome to me. But there is more permeability between straightness and gayness within women's worlds. But then when I watched Thelma and Louise, it was a completely different movie than I remembered seeing, where you do have this deep physical transformation of both of them as they go from being women trapped within patriarchy to human beings who are doing the shit it takes to have power in their own lives. And that kiss felt so earned and like so magical after watching them blow up a gas tanker.
Yeah. But then you have to drive off a cliff after that, right? I mean, that's the thing too, is like, you know, once you go over that. I mean, in many respects, we were talking about this a little bit before the show, is that there is still that level of punishment, even on reality TV now when lesbianism is hinted at. We were talking about The Real Housewives of Atlanta and how there is this new emergent plot line where there are accusations being flung around between Candy and Portia about, first about Candy's purported lesbianism and then about Portia basically hitting on Candy. And there are a lot of things flying back and forth. And it reminds me a little bit of, you know, these various closet dramas that play themselves out. But also there's a kind of phobic reaction in there. But I don't know. I think that there's something really kind of intriguing to see that both women actually won't go completely to the phobic place in this contemporary moment, where Candy will be like, you know what? I'm open about what I do. Sure, I've been with women. Like, that's no big deal. Like, I don't find any shame in that. It's, you know, Portia trying to call me out on it that's shameful or that kind of thing. So I was, like, super fascinated by how actually it now people won't go there to the easy place of, you know, disgust or what have you.
It is interesting how much people don't realize the trope of a gay person must be killed in the course of this narrative to make it all okay. Or lesbians so frequently just end up with men. And that's why Carol is famously based on the first lesbian pulp novel that didn't punish its characters at the end and gave them something like a happy ending. And it was lovely having that movie, but it did feel so very Todd Haynes and removed and a little bit unrealistic. And that's magical about Todd Haynes, but it, like, getting to have Moonlight felt so just, like, practical and something you could, like, felt like it was from our world. And, like, what other happy endings have we gotten? Like, what other... I mean, we got a lot of sassy gay male friends in the 90s, but we didn't really have... Do lesbians ever get to be fun in film, other than as a method for confounding a straight guy?
Whoa.
Well, I mean, lesbians get to be fun in Sisters.
Yes.
True.
That's very true.
Yeah, that's a good call.
You know, again, it's Kate McKinnon, right?
Like, yeah.
It's also because it was Paula that wrote it.
Paula Pell, yeah, who wrote it, yeah.
Well, my niece coming back from Ghostbusters was one of the most amazing things ever because I watched it and I was like, this is good. And then my niece was so captivated with Holtzman, Kate McKinnon's character, and just the gender that she performed, like, blew my niece's mind. And it was really awesome to see that and understand that whatever expression of gender she figures out is right for her, she's seeing awesome people do it awesome ways and sort of, like, you know, just seeing different stuff modeled.
I have a question for Winter, actually, and that's, you know, because everybody always talks about how all ladies of all kind, straight or gay or whatever, like to watch gay porn. Is there an equivalent where something lesbianic that straight ladies like to watch? Not that
I watch lesbian porn.
Oh, okay.
Really?
Cool. Oh, really? Yes. Okay. I was like, you're the person who watches lesbian porn.
It's just nicer to look at. You get balls slapping on you in real life. I want some fantasy. Okay.
So it doesn't feel, because, like, all of the women I have seen in porn, I always just feel so sorry for them.
No, you have to find, like, the right ones. Like, you can also, like, tell from the screen grab, like, this is going to be cool. Mm-hmm. And then you can tell from the screen grab if she's, like, crying in her mascara and it's, like, dimly lit and they're probably in a nightclub. It's like, I don't want to watch that.
But there's no TV. Like, there's no, like, mainstream TV where you're just, like, you don't, like, go back to some episodes of The L Word, like... You know, where Shane's fucking Rosanna Arquette or whatever next to the pool.
No, I like I always liked Jennifer Beals' character, her relationship with the other chick, the blonde one, the one that she was co-parenting with.
Tina.
I always thought, Tina. I always thought their relationship was really cool. I found everybody else really a disaster, but only because this is going to sound terrible. My friend was a lesbian in that juncture of our lives. So I just felt like there was a lot of connection to the West Hollywood life that mm-hmm. they were trying to not only emulate, but they were also trying to be like. Mm-hmm. So I felt like that was just oversaturated. I liked the mature relationship between those two.
Any other lesbians from pop culture who... just
real lesbians
or lesbian characters whose, like, charisma or sexual charisma was always captivating to you?
I'm really obsessed with Catherine Tremell from Basic Instinct. I've always been since I was like 12 years old. I just thought that she was everything, and she's to this day is still so everything to me.
Tara, do you get annoyed with the aspirational lesbianism of, like, the L Word, or do you get more annoyed with the cliche of the lesbian in Crocs?
Oh, well, I enjoy the, I, I can't, the L word thing brings out the townie in me. Like, I feel it's very embarrassing. Like, I think about Karen a lot in this context because I feel like you're so generous. Or you can watch this with sort of, it seems like you watch it with so much kindness. And like, I watch that and I'm just like, fuck all y'all. Like, Shane to me seems like a
Shane's
network misfire,
yes,
of like what they think masculinity is. So that grosses me out. And then this sort of like chemistry free relationships between like ladies, like brooms with wigs on them kind of thing.
Look, when you get a bunch of straight girls and put them in a room. Okay. My core problem with like lesbian sex and specifically making out,
yeah,
is it's just straight girls touching each other's hair the entire time.
And yeah, choreography.
Anytime you get.
Hairism, hair baitism.
But like anytime you get an actual gay woman into the sexual activity, hands start going places, and I get more of a feel of this is what like actual lady on lady sex is like.
Right, right.
Well, I don't know, but I mean, the most recently controversial, like kind of sexual flashpoint was the stuff in Blue's The Warmest Color.
Right.
And
right.
Some people were like, oh, you know, a lot of gyro lesbians I know, we were like, that's hot. That's really cool. I find that very interesting, you know? But, I mean, there are a lot of parody videos made about, like, the scissoring and the spaghetti eating. So I don't know how you felt about Blue is the Warmest Color, but I was just like.
I didn't see that. I didn't see that. But when it comes to, like, lesbians and Crocs or scissoring, like, I love all that stuff because that feels campy to me. Like, that feels fun if I think about. Yeah.
I just, as a gay man, get annoyed with all of the jokes about lesbians aren't stylish, this and that. Basically, and I've said this before, I feel like all of those jokes by straight people mean that lesbians are so competitive about their weddings and they are so fucking beautiful and I will never be able to compete with the charm of a bitch with something to prove. Karen, I'm going to go around. We have two questions here now. The first question is, best lesbian sex scene?
Dear goddess, I mean, best lesbian sex scene. I really enjoyed it. You know, I enjoy the stuff that's kind of off screen a little bit.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I also didn't, you know, so like the San Junipero, like when they're like in bed and they're rolling around and that kind of thing, which is very tender and sweet. And, you know, because there's not a lot that you can't always represent like everybody out from under the sheets when you're representing lesbian sex. So the fact that, you know, you get to, you know, all that like cute cuddly stuff, I guess I would go with that. And also a pretty happy scene, I guess, is in Desert Hearts, where once I stayed at a lesbian B&B where someone had put looped the sex scene like four times at the very end. So when the video ended, they just kept looping the sex scene over and over again. So anyway, I have a real memory about that.
Tara.
Yes.
Do you have a favorite lesbian sex scene from film?
I mean, I must not. There's nothing that jumps to my mind, and I feel like I am weirdly Victorian that way. Like, the less that's said, the more compelling I find it. Ugh,
for
sorry.
Me, I was like, oh, like I'll be boring, and I'll just say Personal Best was great. But then I remembered on Showtime's The Real L Word, there was this one episode where this bitch showed up to a party with her girlfriend and then started flirting with somebody else and then got that girl into a bedroom and had brought her strap on along.
I saw it.
Put it on over. I was so worried that you were going to tell me you were at that party.
That was me.
But she put it on over a pair of briefs, and because the dick involved was not made of flesh, you just got to watch all of it.
It was neon green.
And it was so, it was, first of all, just like hardcore. And also, it was hot. And it was a kind of hotness that isn't represented. Like,
yeah.
Because it involved this like real hardcore bravado seduction, like going all the way to fifth real, real quickly. It was pretty great. Winter, do you have a favorite lesbian sex scene?
I mean, anything that Abella Dangers is in on Pornhub.
Okay. And then, can I get permission to use a slur for a second time today?
Of course.
Okay. Who's our great dyke hope? Who is the lesbian that we are watching to shift the way that lesbians are represented? And may I begin by taking the best option? I'm sorry, I'm an asshole.
Nobody can say Kate.
What?
Who is it going to be?
Sarah Paulson.
Oh.
Sarah Paul.
I was going to say Ellen.
I thought you were going to say Kate McKinnon.
Save it. I think Sarah Paulson. Who do you think?
Well, Kate McKinnon's a front runner.
Yeah.
Samira Wiley, though, I'm going to pull her out from, like, as a potential future, like, you know, especially with Handmaid's Tale. That's what it's called, right?
Yeah.
The Handmaid's Tale coming out, and she was the real light and bright, like, tremendous. Oh, a lot. She had a lot of hot sex scenes in Orange is the New Black. So I will, you know, say anything Samira was in. So I'm going to give it to her.
That's a good call.
Tara.
I love Kate McKinnon. I like the what she does. I like how, like, light and playful and not heavy or earnest. But I also, so this guy, Imar Jean Christian, do you know him?
No.
Oh, he does a, so he
open
does
TV.
Open TV beta that is just a bunch of web series, and they're all queer. They're all people of color. And he's a teacher at Northwestern. And so I have also, when I see how many series he gets online, I feel like there's just so much more new talent coming up that, like, in the next few years. I know that some of the people who worked with him then have moved here to start their careers and stuff. So I'm like, I just think around the bend there's going to be some new
future voice. Lesbian baby.
I do. Different people's contributing.
Winter, what about you?
Ellen, only because she has a bunch of houses. She's friends with Jennifer Aniston and Kanye. And she also has been a cover girl. I'll never forget, like, the issue when Obama won of OK Magazine, when I went there. Like, the cover was Obama obviously winning his first election to be president of the United States. And then on the back cover was Ellen modeling for CoverGirl. And I just thought, man, we are so coasting towards, like, awesomeness. And then, you know, 8 years later.
Poop in the pool.
What about, do you have one? Do you have a great lesbian hope?
I said Sarah Paulson.
Oh, Sarah Paulson. Yeah.
I believe in Sarah Paulson. I feel like I love the way that her consistent relationships with like older stately women, like, vex and confuse so many straight people and gay men. And it's like, honestly, as a
gay, I dream about that. Like, I wonder what their days are like.
I mean, trying to understand
their Sundays.
Like, and also the looks that she gives to Holland Taylor or Cherry Jones back in the day is just a kind of relationship that I dream about. And when you look at what she brought to Carol, when you look at what she brought to, like her standing on a stage talking about Marcia Clark, it is this thing of the sexual chemistry between Jodie Foster and what's her name in The Accused is one of those magnificent...
Kelly McGillis
is like this magnificent underlying lesbianism underneath a story that doesn't have any place for lesbianism. And it's just so nice to have somebody whose, like, attraction to women is text, who is able to integrate it into stories that don't have it and don't need it, but she can just, like, bring that to the table.
I'm just glad no one picked Ruby Rose.
No kidding.
Who's Ruby Rose?
She is the Australian lesbian who was on
Orange is the New Black,
who's, like, the new kind of brooding butch who, I guess, like, the readers of Ladies Home Journal anointed as their new girl crush, but I don't know.
Reasonable. All right, you guys. What were we coasting towards, Winter?
We were coasting towards awesomeness.
All right. We are continuing to coast towards awesomeness, regardless of what's going on in politics. You were listening to Pop Rocket. Just ahead, we're going to debut 4 questions with Lisa Loeb, and then we're going to share our jams. But first, we must discuss Max Fun Drive. So you guys, it's the most magical time of the year. It's Maximum Fun Drive, when the people here at Maximum Fun ask you guys to help support us. We are a listener-supported network. And once a year, we ask people if they could find it in their hearts to become members of Maximum Fun or upgrade their memberships. Now, Karen, why should people become members?
People should become members because, you know, it's about loyalty to the people who provide you content. It's about giving back to something that gives so much to you in your daily life. You get really cool shit. You get to be a contributor to new avenues of pop culture or other forms of culture and conversation.
Yeah, because so much of what we do is just a conversation, and it's easy to forget that we've got a perfectly good Christian Duenas here with us whose job it is to take our ramblings and turn it into a real show. Your support also allows us, like, Karen's a professor. Winter has a very dynamic career as a digital strategist. We've all got stuff going on, and being able to have more support for this show allows us to do more research, spend more time getting new pop culture in our lives so that we can share it with you. But Winter, if people did decide to support Maximum Fun, what other kind of stuff could they end up getting? Could they get some fabulous prizes?
They get some fabulous prizes, Guy. $20 per month gets you a Keep in Touch kit, which it's like to help you. It's to inspire you in your correspondence, which they wrote here. And I think that is so fabulous. And you get all of these things. You get note cards, you get a stamp, you get a rocket shaped candle. Do with that what you will. And then for $35 per month, you get a pair of rocket engraved beer mugs. And the thing about that is that you don't even have to use them for beer. You can use them for ice cream floats. You can use them to eat Cheerios out of. You don't have to just be confined to its specified uses.
They're solid.
They're Kristen solid. Showed
Winter.
They're, yeah, hardcore. They're
you
heavy.
Could kill someone
you
with
could.
One of those.
You literally, you could do that
Winter.
Too.
You could commit lesbian murder.
Yes.
Winter, I'm very concerned. If I wanted to make a yogurt and granola parfait,
yes,
would they be able to structurally handle that?
I think they're pretty, the infrastructure here seems tight and legit. I actually think that you could probably make overnight oats with them as well.
That seems amazing. Karen, this is such a great idea, supporting Maximum Fun. I just can't imagine how a person would do it. Do you have any notion of how a person could support Maximum Fun?
All you need to do is go to MaximumFun.org and click on Donate. And do it now while you can, while you're still listening, while you're online.
But Karen, shouldn't I just vaguely intend to do this at some point in time in the future that I haven't decided upon? Why should I do it now?
The road to hell is paved with good intentions. So listen to your heart now. And instead of, you know, clicking on the caviar or the Grubhub or deciding, you know, to get some, like, late night queso or anything like that, give a little, throw $5, $10, whatever you can to MaximumFun.org. Mm-hmm.
So we're asking that right now, while you're thinking about it, you maybe go to MaximumFun.org/donate. Please do what you can to support us because we're showing up every week with a brand new episode. You could show up every month to support us. And please remember, at $10 a month, you do get that sweet, sweet Pop Rocket pin, which is very, very attractive. So please do what you can. Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are
Winter Mitchell,
Tara Jepsen,
and Karen Tongson.
And this week we have a brand new segment. It is called Four Questions, and we decided to ask songstress Lisa Loeb to be the person to debut the segment. So let's take a listen.
Hi, this is Lisa Loeb, and I have my four questions here. Guy wanted to know, he says, Stay was an immediately zeitgeisty song. What's the zeitgeisty song of the 2010s? And, you know, it's funny. I had to think about this for a minute. Immediately, I thought Adele, Hello, because that song comes on and everybody has to sing it and everybody feels so emotional, whether they're even feeling emotional or not.
Hello, it's me.
But then I kind of turned the corner and I thought, what about the song Let It Go? Idina Menzel, she sings the song from Frozen.
Let it go, let it go.
That's a song that's pretty, it's pretty powerful to men and women alike. And you sort of like let down your braid in that one part. Like the cold never bothered me anyway. So I would say that's pretty zeitgeisty. People are going to be singing that for years. Margaret wanted to know, what's a secret addiction or obsession that you have? Maybe one that people would never guess. This question made me go deep, I have to say. And I realized I have a very weird, somewhere in between obsession and addiction, I am always trying to slip into a place. Certain people's voices will put me in a trance. You feel really a little floaty and a little engaged and floaty, and you feel a little bit addicted, like you don't want to fall out of being in it. So I'm always looking for like the person at the passport office or the DMV or somebody who's going to put me in a trance, and it's this very bizarre thing. Winter wants to know, what is my favorite four quadrant song to make love to, clean to, drive to, do makeup, get ready to? The first song that came to mind when I thought of a four quadrant song was Michael Jackson, Don't Stop Till You Get Enough. I mean, it's really the sound of the song. It's really fun to dance to at any moment. And but it's kind of funny if you think about the lyrics too. Don't stop till you get enough. Very practical. Karen wants to know, how does it feel, or did it feel, to be something of a queer icon and beloved by so many bespectacled lesbians in the 1990s? It feels great. Of course, it's wonderful. You know, maybe I should probably play more sort of like gay festivals. It is pretty amazing, though. It's very welcoming. I went to an all-girls school, and so I'm used to being around a lot of women and girls at the same time, and it's a very comforting feeling. And it's funny, when I went to go play Lilith Fair back in the 90s, at first I was like, I don't really like separating out women and men musicians. We're all musicians. But it did have a different quality being around a lot of really supportive female lead singers. There was a lot of camaraderie. And there is some special, like when I play with the Indigo Girls, or, you know, bands that are known as gay bands, who are also just known as wonderful bands, there is something special in the audience. There's a very supportive feeling. So it's pretty cool. Thank you, Pop Rocket. That was fun.
It's crazy to hear Lisa Loeb talk about hypnotic voices. that voice is just like a shawl.
Yeah, it, or a slanket. But it's also, I love that she played with the Indigo Girls, who I want to ask them 4 questions now, too.
Indigo Girls, you have been challenged. Now, Tara, I know that you love podcasts. You probably have listened to every episode of this podcast, all 100 of them.
I've listened to a lot of these, and I listen to a ton of podcasts.
No one needs you to pretend that you've listened to this before.
I have.
But Tara, it's very important. Thank you for supporting your friends' projects. But it's important to understand that every week on the show, we ask the question, what's your current jam?
Oh.
So I'm going to do that right now. I'm going to ask Karen. So prepare yourself, Tara. I don't want to put you on the spot. But Karen, what's your current jam?
My jam is actually just a birthday gift to my mommy. It was his birthday. It is tomorrow. And it's a song from her album. Her album's called No More Blues. And it's something that I got a chance to work on her with about 10 years ago as a producer. And so here is, and this is my mom's real name, Maria Katindig Dykes. And that Dykes is my stepdad's last name. I could have been Karen Dykes. Anyway. So we have my mom singing Triste.
Triste viver no solidão, nada cruel de uma paixão. Triste saber que ninguém pode viver na ilusão, que nunca vai ser, nunca vai dar, o sonho.
So my mom always loved Bossa Nova and Antonio Carlos Jobim. My dad is the pianist and the arranger of all this music. And I just wanted to wish my mom a happy birthday, since I didn't really get her a present yet. So hopefully she'll listen. I know she listens to Pop Rocket actually at work. So
tell us about your mom's career, though. Just tell us a little bit more about it, because I've wanted to know. You post these photos on Facebook and they're fabulous, but I want to know the story.
My mom was born into one of the original Latin jazz families of the Philippines called the Katindig clan. And so they're very much known for bringing Latin jazz into like the kind of Filipino popular consciousness. And my mom is a jazz singer and always has been, and performed with a bunch of different bands that were pretty popular in the Philippines in the 70s, kind of like Fifth Dimension and stuff like that. And then she struck out solo and on her own, met my dad while he was on tour there in the Philippines playing music. And then, you know, we left the Philippines and came to Hawaii and went back. And, you know, they had a long and fruitful career playing jazz music for many years. I was on the road with them a lot when I was a kid. And so that's why I didn't become a musician.
If people wanted to get your mom's album, is it available?
It's on iTunes. It's on everything.
Oh,
so
awesome.
You can find it anywhere. Just look up Maria Katindig Dykes. We'll put the link up on the Pop Rocket page.
Badass. Winter Mitchell, what's your current jam?
Drake dropped a album over the weekend, and I love him. So it was 26 tracks on what he's calling a playlist, not an album per se, but he's on every song. I like the marketing of it. Anyway, the best song so far is Passion Fruit, and then there's another song called Teenage Fever, which features lyrics from If You Had My Love by J-Lo, who was his most recent paramour. So I just think it's sweet that maybe I'm old enough to remember when this song was a hit and now it's being referenced in another song that's going to be a hit. It's just creepy. Time is weird.
Going back there tonight and you know what's on my mind, so...
Even if it was a fake relationship.
If you have a, how old is that song now?
Almost 20 years.
Almost 20 years, right? Wow, that's crazy.
It's terrifying.
I know.
Tara, you got a jam?
Oh, I do. Well, I picked Spanish Flea by Herb Alpert. This is this record that Christina, my girlfriend, and I listen to all the time. This is the dumbest song, but it makes me so happy because it sounds like interstitial music, like in a... Mm-hmm. Or it sounds like the kind of thing that you would watch two little mice with clown hats like roll a ball around or something. It's so, I don't know. I it was one of my grandma's records, and I took a bunch of her records when she was getting rid of them. And so I love this song. This might make you never want me back, but we'll see.
This was a real song?
Yeah. It was like a hit.
The best thing is the way that, like, once every 20, like, him, there was that flugelhornist in the 70s.
Chuck Mangione.
And then we got, who was the guy with the clarinet in the 90s?
Kenny G.
So,
well,
like,
that's a soprano saxophone, but go ahead.
Sorry. So are we due to have some, like, instrumentalist become famous before the decade is out?
Ooh, that'd be good. I would love that again.
Yeah.
Kind of miss it. You kind of need it.
Yeah, yeah.
Like it's pretty great. All right. My jam this week is not a song. It is a podcast. Let's take a listen.
This is Bowen Yang's I Don't Think So, Honey, and it starts right now.
I Don't Think So, Honey, people who are still afraid of Chipotle. I have been going every... I went the week that the E. coli broke out, and I still enjoyed a delicious burrito bowl with smoked Tabasco, honey. I got my life with white rice, black beans, chicken, and now they have chorizo. What's not to love? Get your ass to Chipotle. I don't think
so. Okay, you guys. No, it is a well-known fact that we are the podcast drag daughter of pop culture happy hour from NPR, but it is important to understand that we have now birthed our own podcast drag baby, the New York-based Las Culturistas. It is a podcast by Bowen Yang and Matt Rogers, who basically take somebody from the New York performance world and ask them about their sort of pop culture biography, with the question, when did you realize when did you realize culture was for you? And the answers that people give, from like talking about a specific movie or talking about one of their parents, are always fascinating. Bowen and Matt are really funny, really, really great, super gay performers, who are riffy and fun. Bowen is somewhere between like a 1950s lesbian secretary and Crystal
was
Carrington.
Was that the one who was just talking?
Yes.
Yeah, I knew it immediately.
Yes.
Who loved Chipotle?
Yes, but there's also some deep, deep Crystal Carrington in him. And Matt is this like lovely product of Long Island masculinity, who is just the gayest of musical theater fags now. But his deep and passionate love... You almost got a rant from Matt Rogers about why the Donald Trump animatronic at Disney World should not be given a speech. And they end every episode with a one-minute rant from each of them and their guests called I Don't Think So, Honey. And you just heard the one from Bowen about people scared of Chipotle still. It is so much fun. I would say Sudie Green is a great episode to start with. She is a writer for SNL and good friends with them. And Patty Harrison is a really, really funny, great comic I had never heard of before. And her episode just made me fall in love with her. So please check out Las Culturistas on your podcast rotation. You've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Branum, with Winter Mitchell, Karen Tocson, and our special guest, Tara Jepsen. Tara, where can we learn more about you?
I have a website by my own name, tarajepsen.com, or I'm on Twitter at Captain Dingbat.
Awesome. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Muzo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to Ernie the Dancing Weasel, A Disappointment App, Leanne Q, Mrs. Oaks, Sam Holy Toledo, Knitting Lizzie, Aunt Who Lived in Paris, Loveliest of the Loveliest, and Mince Pie Margaret 4. Mince Pie Margot 4 for the 5-star reviews on iTunes. If you haven't already, please review us. Also, I don't know why we're getting this magnificent reaping of reviews, but whatever is going on, remember, it keeps Margaret healthy. Get in touch with us on Twitter. We're at Pop Rocket, or join our Facebook group and like get in the discussion. We are a production of MaximumFun.org, and our producers are Kara Hart and the charming Christian Duenas.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.